The days are getting longer, and the green shoots of spring seem like only a few moments away. And so our strand of winter tales almost draws to the end. Today, however, we are revisiting the anthology Slow Burn Horror, which kicked off the season with One Candle by our old friend Catherine Lee. And now we have Georgina Pearsall's Within Walls, a claustrophobic, creepy tale of the body's horror. I'm going to throw out a content warning for this one. It does contain scenes of self-harm, so you have been warned. Reading the story, I am honoured to say, is Emma Zadow. I met Emma at the ghostwriting seminar run by another friend of the show, Adam Z. Robinson, back in the autumn. I was struck by her keen intellect, her wit, and her style, all of which she brings to this reading of Within Walls. So, check out the Slow Burn Horror Anthology, now available from all booksellers both online and within walls, and also check out Emma Zadow's plays, novels, and short films, and we'll see you soon for the last of the winter tales, and the return of another old friend.
Within Walls by Georgina Pearsall. Your name is Anna Williams. You live on the edge of a cul-de-sac, around which curls the River Yare, whose path detours through several fields, past four chunks of woodland, around two small lakes, under one road and across another before it delivers you to your university campus. On bright days, you like to jump the fence of your back garden and turn a half an hour road walk to university into an hour and a half walk along the river. This avoids several landmarks you don't like, and, on most days, means you don't see another human being until you arrive. There's a dead crow in the garden when you step outside that morning. You think it's a crow, maybe a raven. You remember what your uncle said. If it's a crow, you think, wonder if that's a crow or a raven. If it's a raven, you don't think, fuck, that bird is enormous. It's strange. You don't think it was there yesterday, but it must have been there for some time, because even in the cold weather, its open stomach has started to fester, a congregation of flies, maggots writhing. Unhappily, you acknowledge that you will have to deal with it. Who knows when someone else will notice? You scale the fence. Your feet are sucked into the mud when they hit the ground on the other side of the fence, but after a second, the ground holds firm. The last few days were grey and rainy, but today's brightness has lifted most of the water out of the banks. The winter has pushed the foliage from the path, and the dead leaves that made the ground slick in the autumn have merged into the dirt. The trees are stark and twisted, their shapes strange without their canopies. The bark contorted into knots. Over thousands of years, the human mind adapted to find faces in everything. You keep your eyes on the path. You try to call your mum while you walk. Travel used to represent a large portion of your free time, and even though your schedule has thinned out in recent months, the reflex to make a phone call as soon as your walking sticks. She left you a message last night, but now her phone goes straight to voicemail, which is odd. She never recorded an outgoing message, so the line rings off then goes dead. You hang up, without leaving a voicemail. The next stretch of the river never gets a decent signal. The river is mud brown and murky as you approach the only sluice gate on your journey and continue under the road. At this time of year, fish mill around at the bottom where the water is warmest, saving their strength, so the surface is undisturbed, eerily still. You get to campus a few hours before your only class of the week. You go to the library instead. It's Friday, which means it feels a little unwelcoming, empty when it should be full. You're reading a book about parasites your housemate Mia recommended. Ostensibly, the book is research for a story you were writing about a parasitical outbreak. Really, it sparked a dark, frightened fascination and a desire to find out everything you could about parasites. There are three more books on the subject in your bag. You keep expecting sections to end like stories where the danger is eliminated or sufficiently ridiculous that you can reject the entire conceit. Instead, they end with lists of known outbreaks, their outcomes, and the species affected. Parasites, as it turns out, find it easier than most pathogens to jump species barriers because most mammals have the same component parts. You're about to pack up and go to class when someone from your group comes up to say hi, asks if you want to walk over with her. Ellie, you think her name is? She's told you at least twice. You can't ask. You can't ask. You ask her about her Christmas. She returns the question, then points out the rectangular bruise on your arm. You brush your fingers over it, a wave of nausea coming up at the memory, and force a smile. Contraceptive implant. I was a little too useless to take the pill every day. You push on, making the strip of plastic wiggle up and down above the pinprick, fast turning into a scar. Wow, she says. Did it hurt? You shrug. Not technically. There was a local anaesthetic and the nurse wouldn't let you look. There was the feeling of sliding, poking through the fat. A little pinch. The ache only set in hours later, as the bruise blossomed up. You haven't quite been able to stop fiddling with it since it was put in, a little piece of rock-solid plastic moving in soft flesh. But the repeated action of taking the pill left you wandering around anxious half the day, wondering if you'd taken it or not. In the end, you carried the blister pack with you, but fishing it out of your bag 6 times a day to check the day marking went quickly from a comforting habit to a strange tick. It's difficult to separate instances of doing something familiar out into discrete events. Every time you popped a pill from the packet and swallowed one looked exactly like every other time you did the same. You explain this to Ellie, and she nods sagely. I should probably get one, but I think me and Josh want a baby right when I graduate, you know? You don't know. Getting the implant put in was traumatic. Having this tiny slip removed in 3 years will be traumatic. The notion of birthing a baby by any method is horror beyond imagination. But you nod, and the two of you walk to class, and you try not to compare babies to parasitic larvae out loud. Your housemate Frank recommended this module. He had been studying history with a particular bent towards folklore, and you're studying literature. The module crosses between history and literature to examine the rituals and ceremonies around death. This week you talk about Hamlet and Derrida and ghosts and disrupted mourning, then derail in talking about afterlives, murderers, serial killers, mass shootings, gun control, weekend plans. Then you go home. There's a voicemail message from your mum, apologising for missing your call. When you call her back, the phone rings for 30 seconds, then cancels itself out. You walk home via the roads, just before 4, and make it back to the house before it's completely dark. You lock the door behind you, close the blinds, and settle in for the evening. The house has 4 bedrooms, 1 downstairs and 3 upstairs, yours being both upstairs and the smallest. The house is from the 70s, but has been through dozens of shoddy patch jobs since. The pipes bang, the floors creak, the roof tiles rattle, and the wiring doesn't make a lot of sense. Your electrician father put a shelf up when you first moved in, and the stud finder kept detecting wires and pipes in places they shouldn't have been. You started the year with 3 housemates, friends you made in second year. Mia and her boyfriend Tom wanted to live together, and Frank wanted to move out of his terrible house from second year. A month before Christmas, Frank shaved his head, trashed his room, dropped out of university, and bolted. You called his parents, and they took the news with a wary resignation that suggested this was not the first time he'd done something like this. They live overseas, so they pay his rent while they try to arrange to collect the rest of his things. Not that he left much of value. It means you can't get someone else to fill the room. Mia and Tom broke up in week 4 and now compete to see who can spend the least amount of time at home. You haven't seen Mia in 5 days, but you haven't seen Tom in 9. They text you intermittently to ask if the other is home before they sneak back to gather changes of clothes, snacks and shower kits and return to their encampments. In effect, you live alone, and are woefully unaccustomed to doing so. You pine for your old cat. You answer the silence with constant, uninterrupted noise. YA audiobooks, EastEnders, cartoon reruns, episodes of Have I Got News For You from 2004. Anything simplistic or familiar, so you can drift in and out of it as you bustle around doing other things. By 10 p.m. you give up on anyone coming home, text them both about the crow and go to bed. The next day is your Saturday shift at the pub. When you get up, you steel yourself to get the bird out of the garden, but it's gone, leaving no evidence behind. There isn't even a stray feather to prove it was there. Not wanting to look a gift horse in the mouth, you don't check the bin or the other side of the fence or the neighbour's garden. The day slips away from you, minute by minute. You're surprised when it's time to leave. You go to work at 4 p.m, you stay until the close. You walk home at 2 a.m. It rained all day, leaving the empty road shining under the glow of the streetlights. The work is a 32-minute uphill trek that takes you past the university and over the river twice, and you hate it. The second river crossing, the road bridge past the Sluice Gate, is the problem. You turn right, off the main road and along a winding road that curls past a disused church ground and an outpatient hospital that has its lights on all night. In the daytime, it's barely sinister, but in the dark, the muffled glow from the windows refracts against the church and throws odd shadows. Once those fall out of sight, owing to another bend in the road, you walk out into the traffic bridge. The road is clean and deserted. There are houses ahead of you, but they're distant and you're short-sighted. The land that separates them from everything behind you might have been farmland 10 years ago, but economic shifts have turned it into common land not worth growing on. Sometimes the farmers graze animals there, but in the dark it's impossible to say if there's anything in the fields. If Frank's past lectures about folklore are to be believed, it's a bad idea to look across the fields at night anyway. They stretch far enough that you can't see the edges. Crossing the bridge is a moment of perfect isolation. Tall trees cocoon you, but they're spindly and spindly and bare, and they drop long shadows over the fields where they block the street lights. The bridge itself is hushed, but the river is loud underfoot. You listen for your footsteps, but they're swallowed by the wind and the water. It rained all night and most of the day, and the banks are swollen, sending water plummeting over the sluice, and the noise echoes beneath the bridge. It pounds in your ears like rushing blood. The path is narrow, which forces you close to the flimsy railing that separates you from a 6-foot drop into the river. The rain's gone, but the wind remains. It rattles the railing and howls as it skates under the bridge. The smell of the river is everywhere, damp and rot and rain. When you look down through the railing, the river is glowing, ethereal as the moon pours light into it. The concrete feels precarious. The shadows over the fields shift in the wind, flickering. Then they start to disappear. You look up at the road. Ahead of you, the streetlights go out sequentially. Starts at the furthest point of your vision. Half a mile up, curving around the bend in the road, then continues up the road towards you until the final streetlight above your head burns out with a cackle. You bark out half a nervous laugh. The wind screams through the railings. You walk faster. Norfolk has the country's highest concentration of medieval churches. You wonder why they kept on building churches one after the other. What were they praying for? From the bridge, you turn left, rejoining with the river as it stretches to the housing estate. You move away from it behind the walls, but it cups up most of the city. You're never far away from it, and sometimes you come upon it unexpectedly. The river is supposed to be haunted, but in the manner of all the local legends that pass from the locals to the students, the details are muddy at best. Rivers make sense as places that might be haunted. People must have died in or around the year, and rivers are a strange kind of alive themselves. moving and churning and full of algae and bacteria respiring under the surface, pushing air out, sucking air in. A body of water. A body dumped into water will, as a part of decomposition, be filled with carbon dioxide by the bacteria, digesting it from the inside out, causing it eventually to rise to the surface. This is why bodies dumped in water by professionals are well weighted. The sensation lingers on your skin, haunted. You wrote all of the feelings down for 3 weeks until the journal disappeared and the feeling that someone was onto you made you edgy. There's a church around the corner from your house. The bell, pre-recorded and just slightly out of tune, pipes out from the top of the bell tower. The church itself is seldom used for actual prayer, more of a village hall, and the bell could be announcing anything, you suppose. You itch for the journal. You don't buy a new one. You get your first pen at 10. A black and white cat with white paws, a true witch's cat. You named him Hades, and you loved him more than anything in the entire world. He slept on the floor beside your bed, standing vigil to keep you safe. When you were 13, Hades started to climb onto your bedside table and cry. He would sit there and screech into the blackness beyond your bedroom door. Nothing could console him. You woke up whenever he started, and you sat up in bed with your back to the wall as Hades cried into the darkness, and you stared out at nothing with him until morning. When you were 14, Hades left your bedside to prowl downstairs overnight, creating odd clattering noises as he pounced at dust and disturbed the furniture. It was an old house, and the pipes creaked, the floors groaned, the roof tiles rattled. You still slept with your door open because you were afraid that the wails and walls would collapse around you and you would be trapped, shaking at the door handle as it held stiff. You practiced climbing from your bedroom window over the porch roof, the safe drop to the ground. Your window faced a line of houses that stared back at you when you peered out, and there was a shadow on your bedroom wall you could never place. No, not a shadow. A shadow is the absence of light. This was a patch of light that appeared on the wall every night, unprovoked, and it didn't dissipate when you drew the curtain. You know, rationally, that the human mind is trained to find human faces and silhouettes in everything, but you don't know where the light came from. Hades has been dead for 3 years. You arrive home to find a power outage. You know the bill is paid. You're the one who pays it. It's gone too. The letting agency stops answering their phones at 6, and it's too late to call your mother. Fresh from the cold, the central heating makes you sweat. Down the road, there's a cat screeching. At what? There are no cars, no pedestrians other than you. You double-check the door and look for the fuse box. A door creaks upstairs. Mia? Silence. Tom? Anywhere with a castle has seen a few executions. A 2016 survey of very questionable origin calls Norwich the most haunted city in the UK. You can find 3 murders in the last 50 years in your district, but none of them have a specific enough address attached for you to figure out where exactly. Norwich Castle used to gibbet prisoners, like a chained hanging, suspending people from the walls until they died of exposure. No one answers. The fuse box is in one of the cupboards, either the weird one behind the fridge or the spider-filled menace under the stairs. It takes you a good minute to find the torch button on your phone. But you find the fuse box and flip the switches back into place and all of the lights come on. So someone was home today, at least long enough to leave all of the lights on. Upstairs, jolted into life, Tom's clock radio starts playing the evening news. The tumble dryer resumes its cycle. The house is messy, but otherwise undisturbed. There's washing up still in the sink and the floors need sweeping, but these problems are deferred until morning. Mia leaves half-drunk mugs of tea around until she runs out of mugs, washes them and starts over. By your estimates, she's halfway through. Tom's coat is on the sofa, and you pretty sure it was his leather jacket yesterday. So he's been in at one time or another. You make a quick circuit of the house, turning off the lights and darting from the room, trying to get out before all the light is gone. Upstairs, the doors are wide open, giving a gaping view of Tom and Mia's unmade, empty beds. You steal into Tom's room and switch the radio off at the plug, throwing the house back into quiet, save for the regular clanking of jeans in the tumble dryer you shut yourself in your room. You keep meaning to call the letting agency because the seal has blown in your bedroom window. At first it just created a draft that made you crank up the heating, fluttered papers on your desk if the blind was up, but now the blind is never raised. Now the weather has started to turn truly wintry. The wind howls when it hits the perished rubber. You sleep poorly. The next day you're reluctant to go out. It's raining again, for one, and bitterly cold. Plus it's Sunday, so there's no class, no work. And there was that thing with the streetlights. You're not acknowledging the thing with the streetlights. It was late, you were tired. It could have been any level of electrical fault. You Google around to see if any of the local news sites have reported the outage. You check the council website to see if streetlights in this area automatically switch off to save energy at night. No luck. Looking around the house, you struggle to remember the last time you spent a full day at home. The space feels alien. You gather up Mia's mugs, hang Tom's coat. Someone has opened Frank's door, so you shut it. You wash, dry, and put away the dishes, even if half of the putting away is guesswork. You vacuum and mop and dust and polish. You tidy your room down to putting all of the books on your desk at right angles. You make dinner rather than eating out for the first time in a week. There was a leak under the floor over Christmas. The letting agency sent a plumber last week who stripped the face from the boiler and tweaked dials, disconnected and reconnected pipes, removed the panel hiding the pipes underneath the sink and tightened joints while you watched from the doorway. The leak stopped and the boiler stopped catapulting between maximum and minimum pressure with no apparent pattern. The floor is raised and bubbled, some part of the underlay swollen behind the point of shrinking back to size, and the panels irreversibly misshapen. The landlord told you they would replace it over the summer after you move out. The floorboards are still wet. They still squelch and shift under your feet, press up and down like skin stretched over fat, water pressing out from between the cracks. It never moves in the same place, like rot spreading unseen. You scratch your arm, scrape your fingernails against the bruise, and feel the plastic matchstick wiggle. You can't shut the door anymore. The wood scrapes against the lino. You begin to dislike the kitchen. The window is too big, too reflective. It makes the room look distorted and lets too much of the outside in. You shut the blind and eat in the newly tidied living room. The church bells ring again at about 7:30 for no discernible reason. You peek out of a window at the front of the house, sneaking into Frank's room to do so, and fancy you can see the top of the church. The original bell was taken out years ago. You used to volunteer with a children's reading group on a Sunday afternoon, so you know the bell is a fake, but you're looking at it like you expect to see it twitch. Frank's books are still spread over his bed. You recall some snatch of conversation from the few weeks you were all together before everything happened. Frank liked to say that the best advice you can get from folklore worldwide is that first, you don't have to believe in something to not want to piss it off, and second, the best thing you can do to avoid pissing something off is not look. You let the blind drop closed. You watch TV for a while, fall asleep on the sofa for a while longer. Mia wakes you at about 9:30, barreling through the door in her usual manner and calling your name. You jerk away and try to reacclimatise, but Mia flicks the light on before your eyes have time to adjust. The room feels smaller. She dumps a bag on the floor, talking even as she disappears into the kitchen and reappears with glasses, produces a bottle of Chardonnay and flops onto the sofa in front of the window. I am so glad you're here, by the way. God, I feel like I haven't been home in weeks. 1 week, actually. Mia scrubs her hands over her face. She's been crying. She's on the brink of bursting, staring at you, waiting for some kind of permission. It's dark now. It wasn't when you fell asleep. The living room has this big window that overlooks the garden, fitted with tatty roller blind. She pours you each a glass of wine and forces the cup into your hands. You sip, casting an eye back over the room. You're about to ask how she is, really, but then... Did you move those books? What? She asks, following your line of sight to the stack of books spread over the TV cabinet. I don't know, does it matter? No, they're fine. Wherever, just did you move them? Anna, more pressing issues at hand? Yeah, sorry, of course. How are you? She starts talking about Tom and how he's the worst person in the entire world, and about Frank and how she felt stronger connection with him anyway, but he left. And over her right shoulder, there's a full moon glinting against the glass. And don't people always leave? There's something about a pregnancy scare and how polyamory is really complicated, and the glass in that window is strange because it turns completely reflective when it's dark outside. You're not down here much after dark anyway, but you draw the blind if you are. Would have already if you hadn't fallen asleep. When were you last in the living room in the evening? You sip your wine and make some kind of assenting noise to Mia, who continues something about an ex coming to town, something about Frank's disappearance. Are you listening to me? Yeah, of course I am, sorry. Do you mind if I just close the blind, though? What? Actually, who opened the blind in the first place? The back garden is north-facing and practically pressed against the fence. You don't get any light during the day. You didn't open it when you cleaned this morning. You realise that Mia was still talking and she started crying again. You start to apologise, but it's too late. She calls you weird and insensitive and storms out, slamming for the front door. You close the blind, but not before you catch sight of something shifting behind you in the flash of reflection. You turn slowly, pointedly not looking at the wall opposite the window, and you go upstairs and shut yourself in your room. Then shutting the door feels like a bad idea, so you open it again. Then that feels too exposed, so you settle for pushing it until it's ajar. Your childhood fear of entrapment put living in the tomb lingers, but it mingles with your adulthood fear of pursuit, and both sit leaden in your bowel. The house feels small, suffocating. Your lungs swell inside your thorax, like your ribcage can't contain them. Frank's history books and Mia's medical texts brush up against each other. You think about locked-in syndrome and about immurement, the practice of entombing a living person. Tom's language student fascination with Latin lingers on the outskirts. Murus for wall, prefix in, within walls. In the natural order of entropy, the more you try to organise your space, the faster it slides into chaos. By the next day, the house has started to slip back towards mess, which is confusing until you hear Tom bustling around upstairs. He's quiet, unlike Mia, not always certain to wake you when he comes in. You go up to say hi, lingering in his doorway. He's unpacking a bag, emptying clothes into his laundry basket, and gathering clean clothes from the wardrobe. He has the radio on, the news talking about a cold front coming in. Hey, might be snow, Tom says, when he looks up and sees you standing there. Just getting some more appropriate clothes. You nod. How's it going? Yeah, been crashing with a mate, you know, getting high, avoiding responsibilities. Life as usual, you? Fine, I barely have class this semester anyway. Mia came home last night, pretty briefly. I know you'll be heartbroken to have missed her. Tom grimaces, folding a shirt. You smile. She was asking about Frank, actually, wondering if he gave his key back when he left. Seems weird to think of it just floating around out there. I mean, I never had any idea who's been home. You're so paranoid. He laughs. If I tell you something, will you keep it secret? He doesn't want Mia to know, or his parents. Sure, what is it? He takes out his phone, flips through a few screens. Frank peers out at you, stood in front of the Rijksmuseum in a winter coat, giving you a thumbs up. He's been travelling, Tom explains, flicking back a screen so you can see a few messages and the time stamp on the picture. Yesterday. His parents are crazy, apparently, and he didn't like the house, so he just bounced. Why didn't you tell me? He looks at you, a little sheepishly, shrugs. Dunno, really. Thought you might tell Mia. Frank asked me not to tell her, then I just knew exactly how the conversation would go. You know how dramatic she is. So I just, yeah. But Frank is like, gone, but safe, so don't worry, okay? Yeah. Thanks for letting me know. You chat while he finishes packing, or he chats, and you stand mostly listening, so it has just been you and Mia and Tom and in and out of the house. It ought to be reassuring. Tom finishes packing and heads back out. You walk him to the door. The sky is threatening overhead, grey and churning. He tells you to be careful. I mean, because of the snow, he explains. Oh, of course, you too. I'll see you round. With Tom gone, you dawdle around and note the amount of chaos he's managed to create. Maybe he stayed the night, came in after you were asleep, didn't wake you in that time. You retreat to your room and find it out of order. You're barely here. You retidy the space. You think about going out for a while, walking around, maybe pottering down to the shops to restock a little. You don't have to do so often. Mia and Tom keep so little in the house that you have more freezer, fridge and cupboard space than you could fill alone. You're a disaster prepared with bottled water and cans and frozen food. You sit in the kitchen for a while watching Netflix on your laptop until you become aware of a persistent dripping sound. You stand up and turn around, ready to turn and tighten the tap. But there isn't any water visible, just the sound dripping on. You tighten the taps. You mute your laptop to check the noise isn't coming from there. The drip continues. You take your laptop and you go back upstairs, and you stay there until night. It's soft at first, crackling, like plastic, not like fire. The noise is sinister. The heating went off 4 hours ago, and outside of your bed, it's maybe 16 degrees. You check your phone. It is 3 in the morning. Your alarm will go off in 5 hours. You have a meeting to go to. You reach an arm out of the covers and turn up your laptop, an old episode of Waterloo Road. The noise seems quieter, but the music stings are unbearable at this volume. You swap to an old episode of Mock the Week, but then the laugh track judders around the room. You roll onto your other side, go to sleep. It's nothing. It's always nothing. It'll be the window. The wind, the pipes, the house is weird and echoey. There's a crackle, followed by a low rumble, and it sounds like it's coming from downstairs. Your laptop screen chimes out and the room is back to darkness. You crawl out of bed and shiver your way out of the room. The bulb in the hall blew a few months ago and you live alone, so it hasn't been replaced yet. You walk downstairs slowly. The rattle, definitely the kitchen, turns into a low hiss. As your foot touches the floor, the boiler gives a final bang, like something thumping on the inside of the casing, then stops. The lights flicker out. For a few minutes, it creaks and ticks, cooling down like a final death rattle. You make a noise back, half groan, half sob, and retreat upstairs. This time you shut the door tight. There has to be something making you feel like this. The next morning when you sit up, still wrapped in your covers, your stuffed bear is sitting upright on the desk at the end of the room. You think you went to sleep with it in bed with you. You do so every night, but in light of that, you can't separate out the memory of doing so last night specifically. You get dressed as quickly as possible in the cold and you take your phone downstairs. The emergency plumber tells you in Norfolk twang that he can't get out in the snow, which makes you look outside for the first time in 18 hours. The door sticks when you open it, crunching over a foot and a half of snow. Paul promises you'll be the first on his list when the roads clear up, but the city is half buried. The river's starting to freeze for the first time in years. You hang up and find yourself standing in the kitchen, looking out of the back door at the garden, where there is a dead crow in the middle of the lawn, lying on the unspoiled snow. Its stomach is open, a perfect patch of spilling red, but nothing is there to bother at the bat wound. Hades used to catch birds, drag their guts out, scatter feathers. There are no footprints around the corpse. Its surroundings are clean. Your phone rings in your hand, startling you, your mother at least. Hi, Mum. Oh, hi, sweet pea. Look, I can't stay on the phone long. I've been calling all week. Your Uncle Robert died. He had a stroke on Friday. Totally blindsided all of us. They resuscitated him. Kept him on support over the weekend, but I don't think he was really there. Took him off last night. Anna? Anna, are you there? Yes, Mum, I'm here. That's awful. Are you okay? Yes, yes, more worried about his kids. But I have to be off. We're supposed to go and pick up the death certificate so we can get started on the funeral. Are you all right? You survey the kitchen, the swollen floor, the leaking tap, the snow creeping over the threshold. Yeah, fine, Mum, you should get on. All right, talk soon. She hangs up. A stroke, out of nowhere. Robert was healthy, then he was a corpse, propped up by life support, then he was gone. You scratch your arm. You notice something in the sink. There's an orange sitting in the plug hole. Someone, Mia, has sliced a line in the skin and sewn it back together. A practice suture. You pick it up and run your finger down the wound. The edges have started to dry and wrinkle, pull away from the stitching. Your implant throbs. When you poke at it, it's hot and red. You scratch at it. Nails blunt against the skin. It's infected, or it's moved. You wrestle the little card out of your wallet. You're supposed to go to A&E right away, but the roads are all blocked. The doctor said there might be some movement, but it's stinging, it's poison. What if it's infected? A little parasite, and you let them put it in, shove it past all of the barriers. You become aware all at once that you occupy a human body. You prefer to think of yourself as mechanical, like wires and metal, solid, impersonal, like someone could take you apart and put you back together, nothing lost. You may prefer to think of yourself as soul, memories and consciousness and divine. You walk upstairs. Ethylene vinyl acetate copolamia, 1.5 inches, delivering a constant feed of hormones. You press on it hard. It moves up and down. You press harder. Has it moved? Where did it start? You're sweating. Action of adrenaline from the adrenal glands nestled above your kidneys. Flooding your endocrine system. Slower but more universal than a nervous reaction. Longer lasting. You are all soft and squishy parts, governed by chemical reactions that will fail if they're off by a milligram. You take a safety razor out of the bathroom and crush it on your desk with the spine of Mia's textbook. You push the pieces apart, spreading them out. The blades are thin and narrow, but they're sharp. You pick one out with your fingernails. You are churning bile and dying cells, tubes and nodes and a million tiny things you can't see. Everything inside you is too big and too small at once, more bacterial cells than human. You wipe your arm with alcohol gel from your desk drawer. It's cold against the hot skin. Have you ever seen a wound you couldn't imagine healing? There are 7 types of basic medical suture, appropriate to different purposes. This would likely require a subcuticular, a stitch that pulls together the second layer of skin rather than the first to create less of a scar. You dig the thin blade into your arm and drag it down fast, hard. You cut your fingertips in the process, letting go of the blade, leaving it sticking out of the arm. You press fingers inside, pinching out the blade. You dig back in for the implant, feeling the movement of tissues, muscle, fibres, leaking capillaries. From the window you can see the river. Stop dead in its tracks. The pain is so delayed, adrenaline dulled, that it feels alien, like a loading screen is separating you from your body. You grip the end of the strip and pull it free. On the desk, in front of you, it writhes.